This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And we're here once again to help you bring out the best in your pet. So if you need help understanding your pet's behavior, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And of course, we have another topic to share. What is it this time, Tricia? What are you doing?
Okay.
What the heck are you doing?
This is fun. I'm actually demonstrating today's topic, and later on in the show, we'll discuss why primates, particularly humans, are much better at imitation than other animals.
Well, you do a great Larry Mueller. Say that. And in addition to today's topic, we'll also learn about some of the critters that call our gardens home. Our guest today is Sharon Lovejoy, the author of A Blessing of Toads. And before we get to all that, we're ready to take your call, so let's see who's online. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
I'm Dan Rosenberg from Midway, Kentucky.
Well, Dan, it's a pleasure to speak with you, and what can we do for you?
I have a unusual situation. I have a cat, a Bengal tiger cat, that I absolutely love. He is very different from any other cat I've ever had. He does something, has done it about four or five times, that is very strange. He's a very playful cat, runs around the house, scampers, follows me around, and every once he's done it five times, he'll race into a room, stop, squat, and pee. And I took him to the vet. I thought maybe he had a bladder problem, took him to the vet, and we checked that all out, and there's no bladder problem, and I assumed then that this must be a behavioral problem or issue. He doesn't do it all the time. I don't get the sense that this is a marking kind of a behavior. He's not spraying, but he's done it four or five times, and, you know, it's irritating.
It's not desirable behavior.
It's not the best behavior you want in your house cat. Let me ask you first a foundation question about Bengals, because tell me about the genetic background of Bengal cats.
As I understand the genetic background of Bengal cats, sometime in the 1960s, a woman in California imported Southeast Asian leopards and bred them to domestic cats. And I've been told by the breeder that this cat is six generations removed from being a wild cat.
And that, you know, I don't know. I'm not an expert on this particular breed at all, but that was also my understanding, that there's a certain amount of wild genes
still in there
in this particular breed. And it's particularly interesting since cats, the quote domestic short hair, the domestic long hair, as the vets like to call them, they're really sort of in the middle in the process of domestication. You know, the dogs are at one end and cats are sort of in a gray area. But nonetheless, they have moved along the continuum. And I'm wondering if this might have to do with the fact that you do indeed not have a typical cat, a semi-domesticated animal, but an animal that has a lot more wildness in it. And I can't tell you exactly why he or she is doing it. The one thing I can say is that animals can scent mark by squatting. If an animal sprays, if they back up to an area and shoot a jet, and by the way, Larry, I don't know if you've seen lions do it, but it's impressive.
They can do it.
And with little house cats, it's impressive too. If it's your wall or it's your couch it's going on, that's whenever an animal sprays, we know it's scent marking. But when they squat, they could be emptying their bladder or they could be scent marking both. Another thing to think about is that if it's a young, how old is this cat?
He's a year old, and he's really just started doing it. He's done it about five times in the last 2 months.
Oh, and he started doing it. We're talking about juvenile, we're talking about a change in behavior, we're talking about at the time where they're going to start getting more territorial. It's possible it is indeed scent marking. It really is. It might be about arousal levels, because sometimes when animals get super aroused, they just...
When he's done this, he's just racing around having the best time in the world.
Well, this is a great place, so I'm going to mark this.
Yeah. What you might want to do, if, you know, it might not be about marking. It might be about just arousal, and therefore I sort of lose control of certain parts of my body. You might want to work on not letting him get quite that aroused, particularly given his background and the fact that he's growing up. And highly aroused cats can sometimes just become aggressive just because they're just sort of out of control. So,
and I'm wondering, how, and just going back to the breed itself, how did they manage to breed a wild cat like that, a large cat, to a small house cat type?
Well, yeah, it's a very interesting question. My guess, I'm not so sure it would have been, as a matter of fact, from my understanding, it's not a leopard at all. I don't think that would actually be biologically possible.
Oh, okay.
But there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of small wild cats that we don't really hear about very much. I mean, the African wild cat, if it came into the studio right now, we wouldn't, except for its behavior, we wouldn't necessarily know it wasn't somebody's cat from down the street. Yeah. Oh. So there's actually a large number of wild cats that are relatively small and are probably genetically much closer to our particular species.
Well, as Dan says, he's got a playful cat. And a couple of weeks ago, we talked to a caller whose playful cat kept putting its catnip toys in the water dish.
Right.
And Tricia, you and I were a bit puzzled by this behavior, but Janine in Lac des Flambeaux, Wisconsin, had an observation for us. And she says, I'm quoting now, having made cloth cat toys and grown my own catnip,
yes,
I know that a cat's greatest pleasure is often derived from thoroughly soaking a cloth full of catnip with slobber, turning it an ugly green. This releases the taste and or smell of the catnip, and by dunking her toys in the water dish, the cat may have just found a shortcut to enjoying some delicious catnip.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. It's certainly possible, and it is true that moist air and moist ground, for example, can carry scent a little bit better when things get really, really, really dry.
Yeah.
It's harder for tracking dogs, for example. So that's a perfectly reasonable hypothesis. I still think the finding the top of the water, because we talked about how cats can't see right in front of them, it's hard for them to find the top of the water. I think that's probably the best working hypothesis, but I think it's very interesting. Well, what we might want to do is try soaking these toys beforehand and see if our cats like them better. We can do some research out there.
Maybe they just like catnip flavored water.
Well, sure. It's like a little, put a little carbonation in it and start selling it.
Lemonade, you know, some of us like lemonade, other of us like catnip-flavored water.
Larry, you got your idea to make your millions.
By the way, how can listeners get a hold of us if they have a pet tip to share?
We love hearing from you, and it's really easy. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And here's the number for you to call if you'd like to join in right now with a question, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, who are we speaking with?
My name is Susan.
And where are you calling from?
And I'm calling from Northern California.
Well, Susan, what can we do for you?
Well, I have a wonderful dog named Cole, and he goes with me everywhere whenever I travel throughout my day. And in the morning when we go for his walk, we usually drive about 20 minutes, and then we walk.
Okay.
And when he's in the car, usually he seems to enjoy it and easy to manage. But on the days when we're going toward his walk, he gets so excited that he whines the entire trip.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually in my ear. Sometimes it's a loud yip, and he's pacing rocks back and forth. He's in the front. He's in the back. He's in the way back.
Oh, my. I'm so excited. I'm beside myself.
Yes, exactly. And it's fine if it's just me, although it's kind of irritating. But when I have someone else with me, they're like, you know, how come you can't manage your dog?
It's just not fine at all. And, you know, it's a very common problem. They just start getting so excited. They really are beside themselves. And they're almost out of their own control. One of the things that can increase arousal is emotion.
Sure.
And motion, you know, there's a reason that the biggest part of the word emotion is the word motion. So it's not only going to help him calm himself down a little bit, but it also is safer.
Uh-huh.
So I would highly recommend putting your dog in a crate or getting one of those doggy harnesses, the sort of a seatbelt harness kind of affair, that's going to, one, make it safer for him to travel, and two, stop him from being able to sort of work himself up in a flather. Now, is this going to completely stop it? Oh, no. Would that be true? But it'll make it better.
Okay.
And what you can do, and this is the harder part, that's the first is the easy part. The part that takes a little bit more work on your part is you can do a couple things. You can either, every time he whines, stop and then not proceed towards the park until he's quiet. And I got to tell you, I don't have enough patience to do that method. I've heard it recommended many times. I've recommended it. I tried it. It was like, oh, life is just too short. It's going to take me 2.5 hours to get to the park. So that's a possibility. Works for some people. Frankly, doesn't work for me very well. What works much better for me is to teach a dog to be quiet on cue.
Oh.
And so what you do is you're going to need helpers. You're going to need somebody to drive for you, or else you be the driver, they be the trainer. And what you're going to do is the microsecond the dog starts to whine, and you need to start instantly. Don't wait for the dog to work itself up. You need to start before it's too aroused. So he gets out the first, and instantly the trainer says, hush. And as they say hush, a piece of food goes right to their nose, right to their nose. I mean, a quarter an inch away from their nasal passages.
And it should be smelly.
And it should be very smelly and very good. Larry absolutely knows it should be a good, smelly, tasty, wonderful treat. No boring, dried corn things, okay?
Okay.
And what's going to happen is you put that food right by the dog's nose, and he's going to stop whining. He's going to be like, oh. There's a piece of turkey in front of my nose. And then you say, go boy, and give him the treat. And you keep doing that, and then slowly ask for longer periods of time between your hush and when he actually gets the treat. So first he's quiet for 1 second because he can't be anything else because he's overwhelmed. Then he's quiet for 3 seconds. Then he's quiet for 4, 5, 6, 7. So basically you end up teaching him hush. So he's stabilized, he can't thrash himself around and work himself up, and you've taught him to hush, and the first time the little whine comes out, you say hush. And often, that just, after a while, you don't have to do it at all because he just gets out of the habit.
Good luck.
All right.
It'll work.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. You know, we had an email from a listener named Allison, and she's having a slight problem with her dog. Maybe you can help this one, Tricia.
Yeah.
She says, I have a 4-year-old border collie named Grace, and I know she has a strong instinct to herd cats, and I just rescued one that I'd love to keep. However, I don't know if Grace will ever get used to the cat. Is there something I can do to get her to stop watching the cat? I can't distract Grace long enough to make her forget about it. Am I bound to never own a cat? Help!
Help, 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 you poor thing. I got to tell you, the answer to this is the title of a book a friend of mine who's a dog trainer wants to write, and the title is It Depends.
Yeah, it depends.
And the answer is It Depends. And I should tell you, one of the things about border collies is that they were literally bred to be obsessive. To have a dog who work all day long in a blizzard and pouring rain, running literally 10, 20, 30, 40 miles a day, ignoring everything but herding, you basically select for a certain amount of OCD. You know, there's a certain amount of obsessiveness in border collies. And they're like all of us. There's a range of obsessiveness. And some, the ones that are at the very end of the continuum, can be tricky to deal with. So what I don't know about your dog is where he is on that continuum.
Yeah.
The ones who are moderate, yes, you can fix that. You can fix that by, and I'll tell you what to try. Every time he looks at a cat, I want you to be armed. I want you to always have something he adores. And hopefully this is a border collie who also is obsessed about playing ball or frisbee, some kind of play. If not, use food, and use great food. Don't use a little piece of dry kibble. Most kibble.
Good stuff.
Yeah, good, great stuff. Yeah, exactly. Larry's got it. So what you're going to do is every time he looks at the cat, you're going to do what you need to do to prompt him to look at you. You're going to call his name. You're going to click. You're going to smooch. You're going to wave the ball in front of his face. You're going to lure him with the food like a donkey and a carrot. And as soon as he looks at you, you're going to give him the food. You're going to throw the ball. You're going to teach him every single time he looks at the cat. If he turns and looks at you, he gets to chase the ball, he gets some food. And when he does it automatically without you asking, you're going to jackpot him, give him 10 treats, throw the ball over and over and over and over and over again. And what you're trying to do is teach an incompatible behavior. And that does work on many, many, many dogs. It just depends on how far at the end of the continuum your particular border collie is.
So give that a try, Allison, and thanks a lot for that email. By the way, how do people email us their questions?
Oh, we love to get emails. And it's so easy. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you have a question, like to talk to us, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, we'll find out what makes primates such great copycats. I'm Larry Mueller with zoologist Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Each week, Patricia and Larry give you great advice that helps you deal with your pet's behavior, but sometimes you want more. Do you want to go in depth into one of the pet topics you've heard on the show? Do you want more advice? More pet fun? Well, why not check out our website? It's callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we take some more calls, it's time for this week's topic. And earlier, Tricia, you beautifully demonstrated how humans are the masters of imitation. But why is that so?
Well, you know, it turns out that humans and other primates are best at imitation, and we really are. We're just amazing at it, because we have large numbers of these special brain cells that are called mirror neurons.
Special. So talk a little more about what are mirror neurons.
What all, like looking in a mirror, right?
You know?
Well, they're special neurons that we've just found recently that they're found in several different areas of the brain. So they're sort of scattered in humans. They're scattered in several different areas, particularly in areas that control movement, prefrontal motor cortex, language, and probably play a big role in our ability to empathize,
That's
to sort of put ourselves in the places of another person.
How the heck do they work?
Well, you know what turns out, it's so interesting, is it turns out that these neurons, they do two things. First of all, they fire. They're stimulated when you make a particular action. Say you drop a book.
Okay.
And so you reach for the book and you pick it up. So there are particular neurons that fire when you're reaching for the book and picking it up. But it turns out that these same neurons fire when you watch somebody else make the exact same action. So if you drop a book and they reach for it and pick it up, the same neurons in your brain fire as if you were doing it.
You wonder how scientists discover things like this, like these neurons.
Well, and I love that you asked, because this is my favorite story about this particular discovery, is that they were discovered by accident, like many
a lot of things,
really impressive discoveries. And it's a great story. The researchers were studying movement in monkeys, and they were looking to see what brain cells correlated with what movement. So they'd mapped how brain cells fired when monkeys moved in different ways. So when the monkeys picked up a raisin that they put in front of them, for example, they knew exactly which brain cells fired. Well, it turned out that one of the researchers dropped a raisin, and he went to reach for it, and he picked it up, and because the monkeys were connected with these electrodes, they discovered that the exact same neurons fired in the monkey's brain when the researcher picked up the raisin as when the monkey himself picked up the raisin.
So if primates didn't have these special mirror neurons, we wouldn't be able to be such great copycats.
Exactly, exactly. You know, there's a lot of controversy about how much non-human animals can actually imitate. A lot of what we think is imitation is actually called local enhancement, where animals go to a place and they're attracted because of the behavior of another animal, but they don't necessarily exactly imitate the action of that animal.
Mm-hmm.
But we humans are masters at it. And it turns out that that's because we have so many of these mirror neurons. And if other animals had as many of them as we do, then they'd be as good at it as we are.
Well, let's get some mirror neurons firing among our listeners here and have them copy down our phone number. What do you think of that?
Well, you need to copy down a phone number, too.
Well, or remember it anyway, 1-800-462-7413. And we do have some callers waiting for us now. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello. My name is Paul, and I'm from Anchorage, Alaska.
Paul, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm interested in a little cat that we inherited from my daughter. And our dog is gone, and our cat, family cat, is gone, and we have a really small apartment, and consequently, this poor little animal does not get a lot of exercise.
Ah.
And she came to us, this beautiful little tiny kitten.
Yeah.
We ended up having her spayed. And
good for you.
And she ended up gaining weight, and we could not, or we cannot get her to lose weight.
Oh, well, listen, and, you can send her over to my place because I'm on a big diet right now. So she's overweight and you need her to lose some weight for her health. Have you tried diet food? Have you put her on diet food already?
Yes, we've tried a couple of different diet foods. You know, the lean cuisine kind of thing.
Right, yeah. For cats,
and,
right.
She's a very finicky eater. She doesn't eat treats. The only thing she'll eat is she will occasionally have a little piece of breast of chicken or a tiny bit of tuna fish.
Well, that's not going to turn her into a big, huge butterball.
She is a big, huge butterball. She's this tiny cat with a big belly.
Well, you know, there are two things that come to mind. One is relates to veterinary medicine. And I don't know if you talk to your veterinarian, but there are some hormonal dysfunctions that can cause that kind of problem. So I would definitely talk to my veterinarian. So if it's not that, and or it's related to that, but you still have this weight problem, certainly an exercise. We need a little exercise program for your kitty. So what kind of exercise does she get?
She doesn't get much exercise.
Well, there we go.
The treadmill you can buy for cats?
Get one of those little machines, you know, and
train
her to use it.
Get her on the treadmill.
Yes.
Well, the first thing I do is I go out to a pet store and I'd buy some of those fishing pole-like toys. There's sort of a long one, and there's a string, and there's some kind of a toy. Now, they're very picky about which kind they like. I mean, my cat likes the feathers, and she doesn't like, you know, the little stuffed mouse. So buy a couple. It's not going to kill your budget. They're not too expensive. See what she likes best, and start slow exercise sessions. And, you know, you can sit on the couch.
Yeah, you don't have to do
that. Although it would be good for you, too, right, to go running around. You can even train cats, and some cats are amenable to this. Others aren't, I should say. But some cats are amenable to learning to wear a harness and go on walks. You can walk them like you do dogs. It depends on your neighborhood, depends on the cat. But certainly lots and lots of play. Start slowly. Don't overwhelm her. You don't want to have some sports injury. Be at the sports medicine facility for felines. But that's probably, if it's not something medical, but I would check that out, then I think you just need to start a little exercise program, at least maybe 3 times a day to start. 3, 4, 5 minutes, and then you can gradually increase it.
Makes good sense. Paul, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. Good luck. 1-800-462-7413, our number to call. Hello there. You're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Karen from Skagway, Alaska.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a kitty cat who has taken to soiling my bed.
Uh-oh.
And it's such a drag.
Oh, it's horrible.
She hasn't always done this, and she started doing it when I remarried, and she got combined with his cat, so it's like his and hers, and they hate each other. Well, she hates him.
Oh, dear.
And so I don't know if she's punishing me for putting her through this, and it's real random. I have to move every 6 months. I have two homes in between Alaska and Colorado, and she mostly just does it up north in Alaska. Maybe once, I can think of one time, that she soiled the bed in Colorado in 5 years. But up in the summer when we're up north, she does at least 3 times a summer. It's real random.
Huh, only 3 times a summer.
Have you
taken her to your veterinarian for a full health check? Because in my experience, the most common reason that cats urinate on beds is because they have some kind of pain or illness.
Oh.
So have you talked to your vet yet?
Never about that, actually. She gets all her checkups.
One of the things to keep in mind is that bladder infections are a common reason that animals go outside of the box.
Mm-hmm.
And bladder infections are one of the medical problems that are highly exacerbated by stress. You know, stress changes your physiology. All that extra cortisol shuts down some of the immune system. It's one of the side effects, sort of basically trying to prepare the body for fight or flight, and shuts everything else down that's not survival-based for that second. But when it goes on chronically, you end up having a suppressed immune system. That's why students get sick during finals week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all know about that.
So
given these moves and this stressful situation between the cats, that could be possible. It could be that she has some sort of minor problems and it sort of comes and goes, flares up, goes away related to that. But I would certainly, the next time it happens, I would definitely take the cat to the veterinarian. And it's better to take the cat and have the sample come directly from her bladder. You know, an easy thing to try that couldn't possibly hurt anything is to try that pheromone called Feel-Away. That's the brand name of it. It's based on the pheromone of the cheek glands of an affiliative, friendly, calm, relaxed cat. And there is some research that suggests that it appears to calm cats and it has decreased inappropriate elimination in a mixed percentage of cases from 30 to sort of 60%, depending on the kind of case you're looking at. The longer it's gone on, the less effect it's going to have. So you certainly want to do
something
now. Is that
something I put in her kibble? Or?
You know, it's actually, it's a pheromone that drifts through the air. So you
plug it in.
You would, I would actually get two versions of it. One's a plug-in, as Larry mentioned, which is lovely. It's the perfect behavioral problem solver. Spend money and you plug something in and forget about it. But the other thing is you can buy it as a spray. I would spray the bed with it. That's the other thing to do.
You know, maybe I've used animal communicators in the past, but maybe I could talk to her. We're actually going to stay here year-round now. So she won't have to spend 2 weeks a year in a truck.
You know, if it helps you, then you do it.
And maybe I can ask, talk to her and say, gee, what do you think if we stay here? Would that be easier?
Mm-hmm.
Or why don't we make the other cat go?
Well, I was thinking of that, too. That's another possibility.
That's another possibility.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
Good luck, Karen. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Coming up next, we'll talk with an author whose love for her garden led her to realize the blessings of toads. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Even man's best friend has a fault or two, so bring out the best in your pet with great advice from Trisha's dog training books. If you need help with a multi-dog household, or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, Trisha has a book that can help. Call the radio store at 800-747-7444. That's 800-747-7444, or visit our website at callingallpets.org.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and we're happy to welcome Sharon Lovejoy to the program. Sharon is the author of several books and essays focusing on gardening and nature, and today she joins us to talk about her book entitled A Blessing of Toads, A Gardener's Guide to Living with Nature. Welcome to the program, and thanks for being with us today, Sharon.
It's my pleasure.
Why are toads a blessing?
They're a blessing because they can eat their weight in bad guys every night. And if you've ever watched them work, they'll just go to every corner of the garden and eat larvae and eat all the things that are eating your plants. And in fact, they're so beloved, or they were so beloved, that they used to sell them on the street corners in Britain in the 1800s.
No kidding.
You know how you think of people selling flowers and lavender? Well, they'd say, a shilling for a toad. They were worth their weight in money.
That's fascinating. I had no idea.
Yes. They were very beloved. And if you've ever spent time watching them, you know that they will help you in the garden.
Sharon, how did you become so tolerant of all the creatures in your garden? You know, they're not all helpful, and there's some that most people would consider to be pests. How did you become so tolerant of everybody out there?
I think that my early interactions with my grandmother Lovejoy, I lived in a little cottage in the middle of her garden, and I was exposed to everything from skunks, which I love, snakes, lizards, horned toads, you name it, trapdoor spiders, wasps. And she taught me to just sit quietly and watch things and learn how they live and try to understand them. and that if I was really gentle and quiet around him, I'd be fine. And that served me well, believe me.
What a wonderful legacy.
Yeah. It is a good legacy. I even used that. I worked for the Smithsonian at one time, went to Baja California and studied the whales, the gray whales, and would sit out in a zodiac, and they would come roll along the side of my boat. And, you know, they'd go 40 feet past me, scrunching along the bottom of the boat, and then roll over me and look at me with those huge eyes, huge cow-like eyes.
Oh,
and
boy.
I thought, they're understanding how I feel about them. They'd lift their fluke right by the end of my zodiac, and I could gently lay my hands on the end of their fluke. It was like a warm rubber tire, and they'd roll their eyes. They felt it. Here they were 40, 45 feet long, and they felt, I think they felt the way I felt about them, which was lots of love.
Lots of love there. But you had a painful childhood encounter with another being, a wasp, and with some wasps, but yet you've come to embrace wasps and even encourage them into your garden. Why?
I have, because, well, first of all, I had the apricot pickup. Anytime you pick up fruit, you know that you're liable to grab a wasp. Or if you make them mad and they come after you, they don't sting you just once like a honeybee that loses its stinger. They'll sting you many times over and over.
And they'll follow you.
They do follow you.
And I have firsthand experience myself.
We all do, I think. Yeah. You did when you were young, right?
Oh, yes. And that's a terrible sting. It feels like somebody's sticking a red-hot poker into your skin.
It really hurts, too.
They seem so mean. But then when I grew up, well, I always had a healthy respect for them after that. But then I watched them picking caterpillars and looper caterpillars and bad critters from under my cabbages and all over, and they carry them back and feed them to their young. And it was just an amazing experience to see how much good they did for my garden. And, you know, we just have to be a little more tolerant. Of course, it's not good if they're nesting right by your kitchen door, and you go in and out of the kitchen door.
That's pushing the boundaries a little bit, right?
Yes, yes, yes. But they are wonderful. They do help keep the balance in a garden.
Are there any creatures you'd consider unwelcome to your garden at all times?
Well, when I have I love all animals, but sometimes things are not compatible. For instance, when I dig a new bed and I've got wonderfully loose soil, I think there's a sign that goes out in front of my yard that says, "Neighborhood cat, please come and use Sharon's garden as a bathroom." So what I do is, in my freshly dug beds, especially when I've just put down seeds or young plants, oftentimes I'll lay down long sheets of chicken wire, which I'll let kind of undulate over the top of the newly dug soil, because if you watched your kitties in the garden, you know they like a nice soft area. They don't want to scratch in chicken wire. Your plants can still come up through the chicken wire, but the cats can't dig. I've also used wax paper, and I've used tin foil, aluminum foil on the ground.
Those are great ideas.
You know, those things are friendly. They don't hurt the animal at all, and they give a little protection to the plants, the seedlings.
Oh, yeah.
Of the animals featured in your book, which do you believe is the most misunderstood?
I think people really, really do not understand snakes and spiders.
Mm-hmm.
I can actually show slides at a presentation where I'm explaining about these animals. And there's a thing called omphetophobia, which is a fear of snakes that they've tracked in people that have never even lived in an area close to snakes. It must be something deeply in our genetic makeup that says stay away from this long wriggling thing.
Yeah, there is some research on that actually.
Yeah.
There is a kind of an innate response.
Right. And then spiders, even young children. And when I teach children's groups, I have a plastic spider that I use, and they're even afraid to touch that.
Do you think people would treat their gardens differently if they thought of it as part of nature and not just sort of, quote, a garden?
When you said that, I saw a woman standing there with this big bullwhip saying, "I will subdue you, I will subdue you." I do think that people don't realize that their gardens are really critical. Their gardens are part of this huge, beautiful puzzle that is our natural world. And that's why it's so critical that people not use poisons, sprays that'll harm all the beneficial things in their garden, that'll harm the water table, that'll harm children, that'll harm frail elderly people or just ill people. They don't realize that it's a very important part. And when people say, oh, one garden can't make a difference, I just have to laugh and say, excuse me, I took a garden in the middle of a drought-stricken area, and all of a sudden, after putting in a pond, red-legged frogs and things arrived that had never been here before, an endangered species, red-legged frogs, and tree frogs, and all of these other things that are just amazing miracles, and it's because one garden can make a difference.
That's really inspiring.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
That really, was great.
Really,
my pleasure. You guys are wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. Sharon Lovejoy is the author of A Blessing of Toads, A Gardener's Guide to Living with Nature. She joined us today from her home in Cambria, California. And if you'd like to join us on the program, it's easy. Just give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And let's move on to another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
My name is Ken, and I'm calling from Buffalo, New York.
Ken, I thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, my subject is a little more mundane than Sharon's. My wife and I own a year-and-a-half-old golden retriever named Ginger, who's the most beautiful dog that's ever existed,
aww,
of course.
We good. Believe you.
And she's brilliant, and all she wants, she lives to please us, which is wonderful.
It is.
That is
we
wonderful.
Love all that,
it's
but there's
rare,
one thing
yeah.
that doesn't please us about Ginger's behavior. She, when left alone in the backyard, which really isn't a very large backyard, Ginger loves to dig holes.
Oh, of course she does.
Well, is she going to grow out of this?
No.
No,
she's
never.
A dog. They love to dig. So
well, this is a problem because our backyard looks like a place where someone has been lobbing hand grenades.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Oh, dear,
yeah.
Not much
and,
of a garden.
And my wife and I, when we go to mow the grass, we fall into these holes. Now, these holes are sometimes as deep as a foot and a half.
Yes, I believe you. It's amazing how far down they can go.
Right. Now, at first we thought she was trying to escape and doing her impression of Steve McQueen or something like that. But it's really not the case because she's really happy back there. And if we give her a chew, she's fine. That being the case, if we don't leave her with something to chew on, she immediately attacks lawn.
Gotcha.
And
part of why she does that is because she's a year and a half old, and she's full of energy, and she'd much prefer to do something with you, but you're busy, so she has to entertain herself. And what better thing to do than to have a good dig, because dogs just love to dig. So what you need to do is, this is very much a handleable problem, that's the good news.
Oh, good.
But you're going to have to change your behavior in order to change hers.
Right.
So what she needs is she needs mental exercise and she needs physical exercise. So in the time that you say you need to be dealing with life and you just can't always attend to your dog, keep her in the house and give her all kinds of toys. Get the hollow toys that you can stuff food inside. Get the toys that are interactive toys where you put kibble inside, and if the dog rolls it around the right way, then one piece at a time comes out. That can keep them really busy.
Okay.
There are all kinds of toys, and you're absolutely right, good for you. Don't leave a dog alone with a rawhide chew.
Okay.
It's not healthy. They can choke on small pieces on rare occasions, but it happened to me, so don't let that happen to
oh,
you.
Boy. Yeah.
I would do lots more interactive work with her. I would take her outside, play a fetch game, tell her to go potty, bring her inside, and then do what you need to do. Keep her inside. She's young. She's going to be, I want to be busy. I'm not tired yet. So give her one of these interactive toys to play with, to chew on. You can even teach her to go, you can even play hide and seek with a dog. You're cooking dinner. You teach them to go find. You start with hiding something. You don't even hide it. You put it 2 feet away, and then you put it next time sort of behind the door frame, but it's still only 2 feet away, and half of it, you know, half of it sticks out,
it
so
out.
They can still see it. And then it's a little harder to find. And over a period of months, in 4 to 6 months with most dogs, and some dogs in 2 to 3 weeks, you can teach them, go find your toy. And they'll spend a half an hour looking for the toy that you hid in the closet upstairs.
Oh, man.
So that's something to do. And I also mentioned the importance of letting her dig, but just teaching her a place to do it. Go find a place. It's a designated digging place. Keep the soil
Diggable,
yes. So you dig it up, get the grass off yourself, mm-hmm. dig up the soil, put some sand in there, go out there, and you dig and go dig it while she watches you, and she's going to think you're crazy.
Yeah. Maybe you stick, do you stick bones or something in
there? Yeah, good, Larry treats? Remembers that I've talked before about take some treats and some bones, half bury them so she has to dig for them, and then whenever she starts to dig somewhere else, you're going to be out there with her, aren't you? Because you're not going to leave her there alone.
I get you.
And
sure.
you're going to say, uh-uh, and you're going to take her over to her digging place.
Oh, that's great.
So give that a try.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Don't go away. We'll take more calls next. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets.
Do you have a question for Patricia? I know. Just call the 1-800 number, right? But you're shy, and the idea of talking on the radio gives you hives. So how do you get your question on Calling All Pets? We have a solution. It's called email. Send your pet behavior questions to pets@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. And if you'd like to join our conversation, here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. Give us a call. Tricia, we received an email question from Kimberly in Madison, Wisconsin, and she has this question for you.
Okay, I'm all ears.
All right. As a gift, my mom gave me bright red flannel sheets to replace the boring white ones I've been sleeping on.
Bright red. Woo!
Yeah, and my 4-year-old tabby cat, Casanova, has never had any problem with the white flannel sheets. However, he's terrified of the red sheets.
No kidding.
Yeah, if they're balled up on the bed prior to being made, he's fine. But once the bed is made and the sheets are spread out, he won't get on the bed. And so what do I do to make him okay with the red sheets?
No kidding.
Are cats afraid of the color red?
I have never known that to be true.
Please don't make me go back to these boring sheets.
I don't want my white sheets. And, you know, I'm filtering through my brain about visual, you know, color acuity in cats. And, boy, you know, I can tell you just right off about color vision in dogs. And I'm thinking, cats, and nothing's coming up. So I'm going to have to go research that because I don't remember. I know dogs are red, green, colorblind. Don't know about cats.
Ah.
But one of the most important things I can say is that, you know, it might not be the color. We're primates, and we are so programmed to pay attention to color, particularly red. We have a lot of receptors that help us see red. Gets a tremendous amount of our attention. It well might be the smell. It could be the smell. It could, and that's actually the most likely.
The new sheets.
Yeah, that's the most likely. So one thing she might want to do is just leave them around so they pick up the odors of the house. Wash them first, perhaps, and then leave them in the bedroom just hanging out in the corner somewhere. She could sit on them a lot just to get her scent on the owner, just to get her scent on them. You could try spraying them with Feel Away. That's another possibility.
Well, the cat would know white as a color, and the shade red, even though it might not know the color, it would know the shade.
It could be the contrast between light versus dark. That's very possible. Why a cat would be afraid of a dark lump on the bed, I don't know. You know, one question I would ask her if we were speaking would be, is this a fraidy cat? Is this a cat who tends to be highly reactive to, is this a neophobic cat who's afraid of new things?
Well, he's fine if it's just balled up on top of the bed, but when it's spread out in the sheet, that's when he goes.
Oh, I misunderstood that.
Yeah. It's when it's spread out.
When it's spread out.
Yeah.
Not when it's balled up. Boy, I'm looking for listeners to send their ideas in here. Send us your ideas to pets@wpr.org. I think we have an interesting mystery on our hands.
And we have some interesting callers online. I'll bet here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And here is our next caller. Hello there. You're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Brian in Pocosin, Virginia.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for calling.
My question is to do with the habits of a longtime cat we had for 17 years who recently passed away.
Oh.
She was a very, very bonded to my wife.
Okay.
but somewhat tolerated me.
Go ahead.
Anyway, I learned to live with that. I handled rejection quite well.
You tolerated being tolerated?
Yeah.
That's very good of you.
So, you know, just looking at the whole history of everything, my question, I guess, is do cats differentiate between human male and female?
That's a very good question. The answer is an unequivocal yes, absolutely. It seems to be trivial for them. And I'm wondering that there are two explanations for what's going on, neither of which have anything to do with your behavior. One is that cats who have been little socialized or who genetically are neophobic, mm-hmm. shy, afraid of sort of unfamiliar things, what we tend to call shy, cats like that, this is also true of dogs, tend to be more afraid of men than they are of women. And we have lots of speculations about why. Is it jaw size? Mm-hmm. Is it chest size? Is it voices, low voices? So it could just be some genetics. It could be a lack of socialization. Usually that would be combined with a certain predisposition to be a little neophobic. She may have not been particularly well socialized, and the women are just less intimidating to her. It has nothing to do with you, regrettably, except the fact that you're a guy.
I was beginning to wonder.
Well, you know, the good side, I always tell guys the good side of this is it's harder for women very often, and this is something human ethologists know very well, it's much harder for women to be in positions of authority sometimes because they don't have the same kind of sort of presence that men can generate. But it also means that scaredy cats bond with us better. So there's advantages and disadvantages to everything. But the other possibility, and this is what people usually think has happened, and it's more rare than people think, but it does happen. The other possibility is that she was traumatized by a guy who looks something like you. Mm-hmm. So that's another possibility. The question, the way we can test this out, is to ask how does she behave to other men who are generally the same size and shape as you? Have you had other visitors who were...
Yes, my son came home from college, and he's a fairly big boy.
Okay.
And the cat was not impressed at all.
Oh, she was also afraid of him. Mm. So it is general.
And yet this neighbor lady came in, who the cat had never seen before, sat at the kitchen table, had a cup of coffee with my wife, and the cat was all over her.
The cat my guess is the cat is genetically has a certain amount of shyness to her and was probably spent her early critical period, 3 to 7 weeks in kittens, very, very young, with women and never met any men during that period. So
you're out of luck, Brian.
Yeah, it's sex change operation. You can try classical conditioning. I can tell you sometimes it's successful. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's not. You might want to get another cat for you.
Thanks for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Amanda from La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Hi, Amanda. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question. We have two cats. They're about 4 years old or so, and they like to scratch on the door jambs, the molding, like, around the doors in the house.
Sharpening their claws, as it were?
Yes. And they do have two scratching posts that they do like to scratch on, and they are inside cats, but the doors they seem to scratch on are kind of all over the house. It doesn't seem to be... like the doors that go outside, you know, like they're scratching to get outside.
Okay. And, you know, usually, as I think most of us all know, is that when cats are scratching, they're not just grooming their nails. Most importantly to them, it's a territorial kind of
scent
behavior.
Scent marking type
they're
of
scent
thing.
Marking, their scent glands between the pads of their paws. And also the visual marker has a huge impact. You go to Africa or Asia, and you can see trees just shredded. And you can see it from a half a mile away. You know, it's very, it's sort of like no trespassing. This is my territory.
Don't come here.
Don't come here. But usually that kind of scratching you do find on entrances to the house. First thing to do whenever you're changing a bad habit is to prevent that habit from happening. You want to quit smoking cigarettes. You don't sit in a house covered with cigarettes. You don't go to bars where everybody smokes. You know, you don't have any cigarettes in the house for a while. So the first thing to do is to block access. And it sounds like probably a lot of doors in your house. So
we have tried, like, the double-sided sticky tape.
right.
thing. And, you know, of course, they'll quit scratching because the tape's on it. And I'll tape up every door in the house.
Okay.
And I take it down, and they start doing it again.
They start doing sure. it again.
And they also know that they're not supposed to be doing it. So most of the time, they only do it when we're not home or when they think we're in the other room and
right.
not paying attention to
And
them.
I think it almost becomes a game. You know, they don't have a lot to do. So part of what's fun is like, let's play the game of how often I can get a scratch in when she's not seeing. You know, it's almost like a fun thing for them. What are your scratching posts like?
They are wood.
They are okay. wood?
Yep, and they do like to scratch on them. They
Good.
Scratch on them quite a bit.
Okay, and where are they?
One is by their litter box, and one is in the living room.
Okay. I would get some more.
Okay.
And I would scatter them around the house, and I would go back to your double-sided tape for about 3 weeks.
Okay.
And then I would take it down, but I would only take it down in one place. And I would take, so we're going to take one piece of tape down on one doorway, and you're going to take it down on the doorway that you can hide behind the sofa so the cat doesn't know you're there. And you're going to let the cat in the room, and you're going to have a little pop can that's empty, but it has a couple of pennies in it.
Okay.
And as soon as your cat, and the trick is in the timing, just as your cat begins to scratch on this door jamb, you're going to throw the can, not at your cat, but beside your cat.
Hit the door.
So, yeah. So it makes, you don't hurt the paint, you know, but throw it such that you startle your cat. You're not trying to terrorize your cat. Some people think this is cruel. I don't. I just, unless you have extremely sensitive cats, in which case I would advise against it. But if you have normal cats who are like, ba-doop, 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 ba-doop,
yep.
then basically what you're doing is what's called a remote correction. And it's basically saying, we've told you what to do. You've learned what to do. You have lots of alternatives. You know what? The consequences of doing this have nothing to do with me because I'm hiding behind the cat. So you don't say anything. You don't say no. You just throw this thing and you duck back behind the couch and then you walk out like, ooh, well, what happened? Oh, my goodness. Were you attacked by, you know. So that's been very successful with some clients. So give that a try.
Okay.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Patricia, thank you once again. Always a pleasure.
Oh, it's always my pleasure. That was fun. Is it over already?
It is over already. I'm sorry for that. But we'll be back again. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. And don't forget, if you have a pet tip you'd like to share, send it to us at pets@wpr.org. Calling All Pets is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0127P and bring out the best in your pet with great advice from Tricia's dog training books. Whether you need help with training a new puppy or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, Tricia has a book that can help. Call the radio store at 800-747-7444 or visit our website at callingallpets.org.